Tradition of anarchism
are
starting late.
You're very punctual. We made the Barcelona trains run on time.
That's true. That's true.
That's the only true thing.
Didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, didn't go anywhere.
Well, they might have been able, if they'd have been able to go somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. More than half. Yeah. We couldn't go to Morocco.
Have we started?
No.
Working class here.
I'm here.
That sheep point's already been made for me.
Oh.
No heckling from the trots in the audience. Otherwise, we'll
wait. I better leave now then, haven't I?
We'll wait for the dreaded K word.
Right, are we ready? Welcome everybody to this meeting. We have two speakers, Ian Bone, Past Warrior, and Kieran Walsh from the IWW. My name's Kate Douglas. I'm the Branch Secretary for Buckinghamshire, Oxfordshire PCS, which is Public and Commercial Services Union, which is the low-grade civil service union. I'm going to chair the meeting. I'm going to give Ian and Kieran both about 10-15 minutes each. Then we'll have time for questions, arguments, debates, and I'll get the speakers to come back at the end and answer any questions that you have. Ian, fire away.
Someone said to me at the anarchist conference in London a couple of weeks ago, "Do you believe in class?" And I thought, well, what the fuck's that? Do I believe in Father Christmas? It ain't like an optional add-on, you believe in it. Like, do you believe in the weather? Whether I believe in it or not, it's going to exist, isn't it? And I'm really pleased to be in Oxford to talk about class, because Oxford's got a lot to be held responsible, in particular Oxford University. I mean, basically, every aspect of our life is controlled by people who went to Oxford University or Cambridge University. They used to restrict themselves to diplomacy, finance, politics, which they've always been top of. If you look at all the political organisations today, the Labour Party, now Gordon Brown's an exception. If you're Scottish, you tend to go to Edinburgh University, which is the only exception I'll make to the rule, if you're a bit of a toff. Every other party, Tories, Lib Dems, Christian, Nick Clegg, Oxford University. Okay, we can take that. You know, people who run our lives all went to Oxford or Cambridge University. It's self-selected. Elite, most of them went to private schools. Perpetuation of class rule. But in the last 10 years, there's been significant development. Well, they've not only dominated politics, diplomacy, finance, but every other aspect of our life. Every aspect. You know, from the media to literature to music. If you look at all these bands which are famous, which go under names of, I'm far too old to give references to bands like Radiohead and people like that, they all went to Oxford. So music, literature, the media, every aspect of life, they tend to rise. They tend to dominate. And they rise to the top. Naturally, like the scum they are, they rise to the top of anything they get involved with. Now, I just thought, people can take some convincing this. So let's look at the world of stand-up comedy, I thought. Let's look at stand-up comedy. Surely that's a fair representation. So here's a list of stand-up comedians, and some of them are quite surprising. They went to Oxford. Jimmy Carr, everywhere. Jimmy Carr, yeah, he went to Oxford. Nick Hancock, Stoke City fan, passes himself as a Stoke City fan. He went to Oxford. What a fucking surprise that is. Rob Newman, Alexander Armstrong, David Baddiel, Sacha Baron Cohen, all went to Oxford. The older generation, John Cleese, John Byrd, Tim Brooke Taylor, Stephen Fry, Mitchell and Webb, anyone? Yeah, both. You'd have heard of you must have heard of John Cleese, I don't believe.
Oh, yeah.
A simple Torquay hotel owner.
Hugh Laurie,
no heckling from the older one, please. I accept heckling from younger people. Eric Idle, Hugh Laurie, Griffith Jones, Sir Rowan Atkinson, Richard Herring, Armando Iannucci, Mel Smith, Sue Perkins, blah, blah, blah. I could really laugh, it's, the other interesting thing is they take over the maverick role. What are maverick commentators in the sort of media? J.G. Ballard, Peter Ackroyd, Will Self, Nick Cohen, maybe alternative voices. Oh no, they all went to Oxford or Cambridge. Not only are they not fucking content with running the show from the ruling class, with running every aspect, and I'm not even going to the media, every newspaper, every broadsheet, they try and control the opposition as well. Let's have a look at the left. Ken Loach, brilliant film at R. Oxford. Tony Benn. Terry Garlin, there's a true. Oh shit, went to Oxford, chair of the Oxford Union. Everyone, they all went to fucking Oxford or Cambridge. It's the fucking kids. Oh, well, let's look at someone else. The BNP, sure, they didn't go to Oxford. No, Nick Griffin went to Cambridge instead. About the many things you might hold against Nick Griffin, he was privately educated and went to Cambridge. Every fucking political organisation you wish to know is dominated by people who went to Oxford or Cambridge universities. And what about the green movement, you know, the ecology movement? Well, you need hardly ask. You know, Zach Goldsmith, George Monbiot. What a surprise he went to us. George Monbiot once had an organisation called The Land Is Ours. We went to a meeting in Bristol and my comrade's sister there said, yeah, the land is fucking yours, you fucking own it, you cunt. It wasn't a political desire, it was a statement of fact. There's no one you can look at, any organisation on the left, I won't go into, you know, any organisation, they rise atop with their contacts, with their arrogance, with their, one thing you get from a private education is self-confidence. It's not so much, you know, it's a conspiratorial plot, but they inbreed in you that fucking confidence which gives you the ability to do it. So it doesn't matter what it is, it can be oppositional, they're always there, you know, they're always there. Quickly moving on, let's look at the expenses thing. Am I the only fucking person in the world who was surprised that Tory MP had a moat? Tory MP a moat, I can't believe it. Fuck's sake, that's what they do, they have moats. They have gamekeepers and gillies and scullery maids and...
Oh, don't we use that language?
What, gamekeeper and scullery maid? Yeah, well, I don't blame you.
Ladies don't say anything.
That's what they do, they have moats. That's what the Tory do. Cameron's gloss on it, somehow they'll hate down with the lads. Like, you know, I always like Cameron's missus. Mrs. Cameron, who apparently is a Scunthorpe girl. You know, conjuring up images of steelworks on the teeth. Oh, well, no, well, she is a Scunthorpe girl, about 20 miles away. Her dad owns Normanby Hall, 38,000 of prime hunting, shooting, and fishing territory in South Yorkshire. So she's a Scunthorpe girl indeed. And where are our new Labour comrades in this? Well, they all went to Oxford. I mean, is there anything more loathsome than Ed Balls and Yvette Cooper? Oh, please. Are they parachuted in to save Labour seats in North Yorkshire, Normanton, rock solid Labour Party seats, and they both, they both did PPE at Oxford together, how nice. Even the ones who get kicked out, Kitty Usher this week and Purnell, you know, both went to Oxford. I mean, six of the Labour cabinet did the same thing at Oxford, PPE. When I first got into politics in the 60s, I went, the first political meet I went to was a
Geezer. We got Oxford,
didn't you? Fortunately not, comrade.
Okay.
I would say you were spotted a moat in my own eye. Try any more of your funny stuff. I saw a geezer called Ray Gunter, who was... Minister of Labour and Harold Wilson government. He was a real right-wing shit-ass. But he was a fucking troll, right? He was in the Labour... You look at the Labour Party in the 45-50s. It was full of boilermakers and engineers and shipbuilders and cobblers. Now there is no one who's ever done a fucking day's work in their life in either the Labour Party or Tory Party. They all go to something. They go to Oxford or Cambridge. Oh, Scotland, they go to Edinburgh, then they get a job as a research department somewhere, you know, researching for some quango or a charity, or most often Labour or Tory Central Office, and they become MPs. I mean, what the fuck does Yvette Cooper or Ed Balls know about what's like to be working class in fucking Yorkshire, you know? And this is all down to fucking Oxford University. I mean, the best thing that could happen, the whole place was fucking bombed. Okay, right, where am I? But enough of that slagging them off, like, which is knockabout stuff to do. Somewhere I saw on this, we were talking about working class heroes, and my particular working class hero is a woman called Lucy Parsons, who is a black woman born in the Confederate States in the USA in the 1870s, which wasn't a lot of fun to be a radical in those circumstances. But she was a sort of unrecalcitrant class fighter throughout her life. She died in a sort of fire in a hovel in 1938 when she didn't have the airs and graces of Emma Goldman, never hang out with sort of trendy radical sects. She was uncompromising. She was an anarchist for a long time. She was a communist for a long time. And she wrote some great things, which I think somehow I read today someone was going to do a reading of To Tramps by Lucy Parsons here. I don't know whether that's happened, but it's the most incandescent revolutionary tract you could ever wish to see. totally uncompromising. When we first did Class War, we used a couple of her quotes on the covers. The first cover was, "We must destroy the avenues where the wealthy live," which sounds a bit moderate now, but which we must still do, comrades, a task. However, the second one was a great quote from a go from Lucy Bottles. "We must lie in wait outside the homes and palaces of the rich and shoot or stab them to death as they come out." Which I agree is a bit reformist. And we, things have moved on. I actually stood on the streets and flogged the papers saying that. I mean, you would definitely get little incitement to murder. But the other thing was, she did when, you know, when she was living in Chicago in the late 1880s, loads of working class people were dying of starvation, and loads of people were hurling themselves into Lake Michigan to commit suicide because life is so bad. She got together a group of people and she said, "Well, don't do that. You're going to first of all take some of them with you if you are going to kill yourself." And then they used to go to the restaurants of the rich, and they'd stand outside, making total silence in the snow. There'd be tons of working class, really poor people standing there, and they'd be tucking into their posh food, and they'd be standing there with a banner reading, "Behold your future executioners," which is just unbelievably good. However, swiftly moving on, I mean, I think, excuse me, be a first business late. 5 minutes.
Oh, you've got 5 minutes,
yeah. Okay, but I think most of the people we identify with aren't named people. They're not people with names. We identify with the anonymous people in history, people who've been forgotten, who weren't famous enough to be, you know, candidate. We identify, my particular tradition identifies with the anonymous voices throughout history. We identify with people who were the Gordon Rioters, the King Mob of the Gordon Rioters, the London Mob, the Naval Mutineers, Captain Swing, General Ludd, the Scotch Cattle, the Host of Rebecca, the Merthyr Rising, the Queen Square Rioters in Bristol. We identify with those anonymous people throughout history who have made significant, who basically have been also rescued from the condescension of history, as E.P. Thompson said, by historians like Christopher Hill, by E.B. Thompson, and by of late Peter Linebaugh. And if anyone's not read Peter Linebaugh's,
they all went to Oxford in
historians.
I'm serious.
All right, I said they rise to the top of anything, and historians are no exception. And Linebaugh's got a book called The Many-Headed Hydra, besides that, which is a fucking brilliant book. Which is
Linebaugh didn't go to Oxford. He's an American.
Okay.
Research student, postgraduate at Warwick.
Yeah, E.P. Thompson was at Warwick, and Linebaugh, you should have known that, Andrew. Yeah. I mean, for fuck's sake, if the trots are going to heckle, at least make them accurate. You see the lies, comrade? Yeah, you hear the lies, Kronstadt, Linebaugh. Lies, hear the lies. Hear the lies. From their own throat, you hear the calumnies and lies.
Definitely went.
Yeah. He was a top master of Balliol, so, yeah. A great historian.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that, comrade. So those are the people that that we identify, and not just historical oracle figures, you know, not just realm to the safeness of history. I'm a bit pissed off that everyone seems to, because there's not much going on in the here and now, people are retreating into history. And then we identify with, you know, the AC1 riot, the inner city rioters, the poll tax rioters, the miners, the Wapping strikers, and so on. So retreating in the history is not a way of saying, you know, it's not a way of avoiding that we need to do something in the present. Okay, I'm just going on a couple of anecdotes. One from E.B. Thompson, to celebrate, people may have forgotten about, there's a great thing when the Luddites attack Rawford's Mill in Yorkshire during the height of Luddism, and several Luddites are shot and severely wounded. Bear in mind that people at the time thought General Ned Ludd was a real person, and they were looking for General Ludd. So the poor lad, who was only 18, was conveyed to a local inn where the parish priest was brought. And the geezer was extremely, he was dying, he'd been severely shot, he's about to die, and the priest is over him and goes, "Who is General Ludd?" "Who is General Ludd?" "I can't tell you." "Who is General Ludd?" "I'll tell you, you'll be saved, my son." "I can't tell you." And then his last breath, he says to the priest, "Can you keep a secret, Father?" "Yes, yes," says the father eagerly. "So can I," says the Luddite. That is fucking some bottle. That's the geezer who should be fucking remembered. That's the kind of person that we identify with throughout history. There's another one, there's a geezer I'd never heard of until a couple of weeks ago, called Henry Cook, who was a Captain Swing rioter. and I'm aware of it because the local history site in Hampshire and Mitchell Deborah unveiled a plaque to him in a church a couple of weeks ago. And Cook was part of a Captain Swingwright attacking local farms, and the local aristocrat came down on his usual high horse to deal with the rabble who were attacking the farm and demanding a reduction in the price of bread and so on, and grabbed over someone by the collar, and Cook stepped forward and smote, as it's described, the William Baring, his name was, from his horse. They didn't kill him, just knocked him off his horse, but of course he was executed at Winchester Assizes. But, you know, but William Baring was a descendant of the Baring's Bank. Now, so this Captain Swingwriter who smote, a landowner had been forgotten about in 1831, smote a sort of captain of industry today, and those are the kind of things which resonate through history. So I give it, and Henry Cook's now been remembered after all this time. So we do not forget our comrades, anonymous though they may have been at the time, and we celebrate them as much as we do the Lucy Parsons of this world. Just to end on two little things, there's two sort of radical moments in history which I really appreciate. One is when Cornet Joyce tried to arrest King Charles I, which is quite a big deal for an ordinary soldier to arrest the king, and King Charles said to him, "By what right do you arrest me?" And he just put his hand on the sword, which must have been a huge goose-pimpling moment in history. And there was another one during the Putney debates, when Ireton was chairing the Putney debates, and the Levellers and the New Model Army representatives were calling for the franchise to be extended. Normally, all these things were caught up in religious rights, and again, Ireton asked one of the Levellers, "By what right do you make these demands for, basically universal suffrage?" To which the Leveller replied, by the power of the sword, Master Ireton, by the power of the sword," which meant basically, yeah, well, fucking watch out, we'll do it as our own physical force. And I think, there's been people doing that throughout history, and we should really celebrate them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ian.
Okay, thank you, comrades. I agree with virtually everything Ian said then. Ian, this talk is about working class hero, so I thought I'd better think of some working class heroes. The first working class hero that came to my mind last night was Lucy Parsons, so I prepared.
We did prepare.
A great thing about a piece about Shramps, and that she goes through the heartbreaking description of what life was like then for poor people in Chicago. And it's very lyrical, and it gets you in the stomach, and you think, terrible, terrible. And at the end, when it's all finished, line at the end, "Let's learn to use explosives," which puts it all in perspective, quite rightly. And Lucy was one of the founders of the IWW, my union. She came together with other unionists and socialists to form the union at the beginning of the 20th century. And it's all about class, being working class. The preamble of the Constitution says, "The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of working people. And the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life." And it's that simple. That's what it's all about. The other title of this talk is, "Why is class still the issue?" Well, I think that gives us an opportunity to look at what's happened in the last 20 years. What's happened to everyone's awareness of their class, working class people's confidence and class consciousness? Why is it's been under attack the whole time. Ian was asked, "Do you still believe in class?" I mean, what a stupid question. But we've had reams and reams of books and intellectual discourse undermining the notion of class. Culture's been used as a wedge. We've had the development of cultural studies. Middle class people can co-opt aspects of working class culture to glamorise themselves. But the basic facts of what it's all about have been brushed aside. Why is that? Why is class no longer fashionable? why does class no longer exist in some people's imaginations? It's because the only threat to the status quo is through a class-based politics led by the working class. That's why it's been obliterated. That's why it's been buried. Because they're afraid of it. They're afraid of people being confident in themselves as working class, organising independently of middle-class radicals and intellectuals, because that is a real threat to the system. People like Lucy Parsons are a threat to the system. So because Ian took my working class hero, I'll have to think of another one quickly to go over. But I think my backup illustrates what I think about class, that as Ian said, he linked class war and his movement to a whole series of episodes in the past of working people fighting against the oppression that they were suffering. So the example that I'll use as a backup is Tommaso Aniello. I don't know if anybody in here is familiar with him, but for many generations that name struck fear into the hearts of the rulers of this country and all the other countries in Europe. Tommaso Aniello was a fisherman and a fishmonger in Naples in the mid-17th century. And in 1647, as the Putney debates were going on, in fact this kicked off a week before the debates started, Tommaso Aniello, under a bit of pressure from his wife, because the King of Naples had introduced a new tax on food, call it a gabelle, and he'd been introducing tax upon tax and working people's lives were getting more difficult. His wife said to him, people respect you, you're well known in the neighbourhood, what are you going to do about it? Well, he said, I'll do something about it. And he went into the marketplace, got the price list, got on a barrel, said, what do you think of this, people? And everybody was up in arms about it. And before you knew it, you had a crowd around him. He said, this is what it's all about, this price list. We can't afford to eat. We can't afford to live. What are we going to do about it? I'll tell you what we'll do about it. We're going to end their rule. We're going to go to their houses. We're going to drag them out into the streets. We'll drag their furniture out into the streets. We'll burn it in the streets. We'll set up our own government. And they did that. It was shouted throughout Naples. Before you knew it, before the day was out, this is the 7th of July, 1647, you had an army of Naples at that time was probably the second biggest city in Europe. Maybe third, after London, Paris, Naples. You know, this was a major centre in Europe. All the working people came out. The administration, the rulers were out on the rear. They had to evacuate the town. Some were killed, some were executed. And basically a workers' republic was pronounced in Naples in 1647. It's associated with Tommaso Aniello. Massa Aniello, the great demon. His name spread around Europe like wildfire. All the rulers were saying, we must control the people. They were getting ideas from Massa Aniello. And sure enough, it did spread around Europe like wildfire, because Naples was the centre of commerce. Seafarers from all over Europe passed through Naples. And the Putney debaters mentioned in the debates events that were happening in Naples. One of the participants at the end, one of the soldiers of the New Model Army, said, the people in Naples have got the right idea how to approach these matters. They're sitting there debating with Henry Ireton and the leaders of the army. And some of them felt what they needed to do, like you said, was run them through, take over, institute a workers' republic. Class, for me, it's not an invention or a phenomenon of the 19th century. The working class didn't arrive with industrialisation. The working class is the people. The people who are oppressed. The people who don't have. The majority of the people. And that is why the discourse of class has been pushed aside in the last 20 years, because it's too explosive. It's too dangerous, especially in an era where capitalism is on, you know, the advance. Part of that advance was smashing working class organisations, smash working people's confidence, smash working people's awareness that they even exist as a class. Atomise, isolate, use any method whatsoever, give them ideas, get them thinking about their culture, about their specific culture and how they're different from other people. Another thing that Lucy Parsons said in a speech to the first conference of the IWW is, let's sink our differences. Let's sink all our differences in terms of religion, in terms of culture, and even in terms of politics. Accept that you're working class and that there's only one proper mode of behaviour for you, and that's opposing the rulers.
Thank you very much. I've got 20 minutes or so for disagreements, agreements, comments, questions. Fire away.
There's kind of one bunch of heroes of mine is the people who, when the when Otmore, just north of Oxford, was enclosed, as it eventually was in the 1820, they finally enclosed, the landowners finally enclosed Otmore after a succession of confrontations which the commoners defeated them. But eventually it was enclosed, and all the people of Otmore just went round Scotland tearing up the fences. The militia was sent, arrested everybody, and brought them into Oxford. At the time of St Giles' Fair, and the people in St Giles' Fair attacked the militia set them all free. That sounds like the kind of thing that happens in other countries these days. You know, when I heard that story, I thought, at the same time there were these wonderful riots going on in Ecuador against the privatisation of water. People thought, that's not right. You know, they came out on the street, and the government were in fear of their lives, as they should have been. And there's that electric instant response to injustice that has been, well, hammered out of us, I guess. And it's the power of intimidation that I think about a lot, about the investment in intimidation, how people can find that courage again to respond that instantly and as vigorously.
Perhaps I could add a footnote to that. The Otmore writers were writing against the enclosure of common land, the land where they grazed their geese, and that made a difference. Just to graze your geese on that land brought an income of average income of about £50 a year, which is a hell of a lot of money. And when they were arrested and rounded up because the land was drained by the enclosures, and they built a big sort of aqueduct to carry the water away from Otmore, and the rioters tore down this aqueduct, so they reflooded the Otmore, so that for the geese, and so it couldn't be turned into agricultural land. And when they were arrested and brought into Oxford, they escaped. And by a happy coincidence, the people of Jericho gave them refuge where we are now.
Okay, thank you. Comrade there, and then the comrade at the back.
Well, of course, that's, important. We're talking about the working class, or peasantry, maybe, in that case, or people of the countryside. An oppressed class. Now, with Kieran and Ian, I like the spirit of what they're saying. The spirit is essentially correct, and it's very entertaining because Ian.
Well, get to the butt.
I'm going to get to the butt. Did you find that sort of thing? There's a kind of counter.
Just get to the butt.
We've heard about this.
Well, let's hear it. Let's hear it.
You see, it entertains go through and say, well, yeah, this fucker went to Oxford and this one did too and then this one did too. But of course, then we get to people that we cut. Christopher Hill. But don't say that Christopher Hill is a fine historian. He was a member of the Communist Party, Christopher Hill. Supports the Communist Party. Pardon?
Stalinist.
He was a Stalinist.
About these things, so watch what you say.
Kieran, I'm sure you'll have the right of reply. He was master of Balliol. The point I made surely is this: class, the question for, of the working class is Hazel Blears, tell me, is she from, did she go to Oxford? No, she's a Salford girl, Hazel Blears. But she has never supported the working class, has she? Never. But she is working class. So the question of class can't be represented in these terms. What class are you from? If you're from the working class, you're okay. If you're from what happened in the 60s, because of the development of this mass movement of workers and students, is that some of the sons and daughters of the middle class were won over to the struggle of the working class. That's the point I'm making. That's the essential point. The practice, that is the crucial question. You don't look at people's class origins, because that way lies absolute madness, doesn't it? The question is how the working class will win and how it will fight. That's all.
Yes. Comment at the back.
Thank you very much. I'd just like to take on the comment there, a bit about the anti-enclosure rights. I hope people stay behind for the Landers Hour. I was talking a bit. Talking lots about enclosure rights, but it's one of some of my favourite rights. And let's face it, we've always had some rights because we haven't had the power of state structure, you know, all we've only got is our hands and our feet. But one of some of my favourite rights, and also I'd like to make a point as well, the Brits have always been very happy to riot if we felt the need to. But food rights, you know, where normally it'd be, the women would go into the market, they'd seize the bread or the flour, they'd sell it at what they would see as a fair price, even onto the royal economy, and then sometimes even return the sacks to the geezers who were trying to sell it for too long. But another thing about the enclosure rights, of course, when we lost our common land, I'm sort of still stumbled a little bit here, but then, you know, then it ended up in wage slavery, you know, we were sort of marched into the factories. I'm going to make a big jump now because I'm also organising a trade union, elected rep. You know, everybody's shitting themselves. They want 0-hour contracts and such like, you know, flexed time and such like. They've got mortgages or credit card up their end. They think they're going to lose everything. They're consuming hand over fist because they're getting all this money thrown at them. It's unfair, really, and they shouldn't really have to pay it back, I believe, anyway. You know, we ought to fight the bailiffs on the doorstep. But perhaps that's the next thing we ought to be doing, you know. Perhaps we're moving on from the enclosure rights and break rights, and not start chilling the bailiffs, they start coming in with our manners, refusing to pay, and also this workfare reform as well, start struggling against that. I know the workers are doing that at the moment. Bristol Wobbly, by the way, nice lady. So, you know, I mean, I think that's the way forward, you know. It's definitely, there's still class is very much an issue here. We're told we're not. We're told, you know, remember Major and the warm beer and all this, you know, we've all got a satellite dish, you know, the phone call team, and therefore all middle class is bollocks because we can't afford it in the first place. And the bank was giving, so when we can't afford to pay the government, pay the bank, so it was sharp.
I don't know how it got like this. I've not been involved in politics for very long. Seems to me these days, people interested in political organisation, they say they're interested in political organisation, what they're really interested in is their own, like, theoretical strand of politics, whatever that might be. Are you trying to build your, like, little Trotskyist or anarchist group in such and such a place? Are you trying to build workers' power? That's the point. I mean, I've been involved in Glasgow for a little while now. I mean, what I mainly did was lay out a little community newspaper. But okay, my first ever clash with the police was when a guy that a friend of mine knew was being evicted for his house. He hadn't paid his rent because they'd installed all these Eastern European toilets. I don't know why it was like this, but they didn't flush if you put toilet roll in them. So everybody on the estate had their toilets backed up, and this guy decided to take a stand. And although he had the money there and eventually offered to pay the rent to the housing association, they said no and they chucked him out. So about four of us out in the whole of Gladstone went up to this guy's house to try and stop the bailiffs chucking him out. And eventually there were six cops, three guys from the council, two guys from the housing association, and a load of carpenters and people to board up the windows. And it was us four against the whole load of those people. If everybody here is serious about building workers' resistance and community resistance, it's no good just getting involved in your immediate local campaign. You've got to have an outlook which encompasses absolutely everything. You've got to keep your eye on the ball with the unions, you've got to keep your eye on the ball with community centres, outreach groups, the whole bloody lot. You've got to keep your eye on absolutely everything. And if you're going to be serious about it, that's what you've got to do. There's no mistake. There's no point in making excuses about it. When I look back on that occasion in Glasgow, when a guy was being evicted, we had a network, a loose social network, of people across the Anarchist Federation, group called Praxis, it was then, the Glasgow Anarchist Network, the Scottish Socialist Party, various members of the SWP, people in local community centres, the whole lot, and yet only four people turned out. That's the kind of situation that can't continue, because you're not just trying to... Everyone's been trying to build up their political organisation for the last 20 years. Obviously that's not worked. These things have just gone down and down and down and down. Everybody's got to reach out to everybody else, because the whole point is building class organisation, not just your own little organisation, because you're never going to get everybody to agree with you. It's got to be class organisation. Anything you can do to further class organisation where you're in, that's where you're at. And if you can convince people to your particular line, then that's cool as well. But class organisation.
Okay, well, that's partly what this meeting was about, how working class people have organised in the past and how we can organise in the future. And I don't know if anyone wants to make any comments about that before I ask the two speakers to come back on the questions raised. How we can organise in the future. We know there's a need to.
What's the common green socialist job?
Well, I think assumption that working class, everything working class is good and, you know, everything else is rubbish, but I think that's not necessarily the case, is it? You know, I mean most of the BNP people vote BNP were working class, has to be said. Let's not stop idealising the working class. You know, let's face it, a lot of them share the same prejudices as the aristocracy, the ruling class, you know, the racists, they like hunting and fishing and sports and all this shit. Yeah. You know, so, you know, let's stop having, you know, that's the first thing, we've got to stop having these, you know, I think before we can build any class organisations, we've got to stop thinking, you know, the bloody, this bloody perfect. And what's wrong with looking for alliances from different well-meaning middle-class people? You know, why rubbish their contribution just as... You know, by some accident at birth, they were born with, you know, privileges that we don't enjoy. Just not common.
Yes.
Yeah. I thought you put your
own. Oh,
yeah. I'm just trying to draw a few strands together. I mean, yeah, I think it's true what Andrew said, that I don't think we should let all the bright young minds of Oxford and Cambridge benefit the bourgeoisie. I think we should win them to our side if we possibly can. To choose the side of the working class, but that's the essential thing. It's making a conscious decision that yes, the working class is the class that can change things. Obviously, we've got a problem at the moment. I mean, what you said, even if we all joined together, you know, those of us from the left at the moment, on the revolutionary left, we wouldn't be enough. I mean, our problem at the moment is that the level of class consciousness is very low, that people don't...
Well, socialism is a middle class phenomenon.
Well, it is of today. Yeah. Yeah, it's true that most people are actually on the left are actually middle class.
Yeah,
and that's our problem. There are things there that we can't change just as activists, but there are things, but that's not to say there aren't things that we can do to try and play our part. Well, it's about preparation, really. I suppose it's, at the moment people are so convinced that, they're powerless, that they can't do anything, that they're only union leadership lets them down time after time, and they just don't have the belief that they can change things. But I think two things, basically. One, that shouldn't make us let go of the idea that it's the working class that's centrally important, and therefore that's where our ideas belong, and that's where we should be trying to spread them and trying to convince people. But at the moment it's a question, I think, and this might sound a bit having small aims, but it's a question of finding those few people who are out there in the working class, you know, who feel frustrated as well by the situation, by the fact that they can't do anything, and trying to give them the perspective of preparing for the future when there will be more people behind us, you know, the last 20 million is not doing anything.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to ask the speakers to sum up now. Ian, would you like to go first?
I won't answer the question. It's a classic politician question. I think Orwell said a great thing. He said the trouble with most radicals or revolutionaries is they don't share the common culture of their country, and we don't. And agree with most of what he said, but the idea that we persuade a load of oxen tossed to come over to our side and become radicals is the least of our problems. Most radicals, revolutionaries, they don't fucking read newspapers, not just in politics in a broader sense. You know, they dismiss tabloid readers as sun readers. We don't share their enthusiasm for England, for example, or Britain. Patriotism has been surrendered to the right, and there's lots of good about England, most of which the history stuff has been talked about today. We don't celebrate that, we've surrendered loads of stuff. Basically, we just don't share the common culture of most of our working class fellow human beings, and until we do that, we'll still be, you know, at the mercy of a load of Oxford toffs sort of coming over to our side and leading the revolution like Terry Carley with his Harrods bag jogging around fucking Amsterdam.
Excuse me. I know you're on debate in Pekin College, my cousin, he's in Washington, right? Well, he went to his mum paid for him to go to college, and his dad was in the docks. And he managed to do that, my auntie didn't. He's in Washington. I'm just saying what he was like. His father, well, his dad saved as much as he could for his son to go to.
Yeah.
With
my parents, you know, I went to Swansea University, you know, and my parents were really pleased. I was first generation ever went. There's nothing wrong with aspiration and work. That's just a totally different ball game than sort of Oxford kind of heads up start that gives you through your connection and self confidence.
What do you think Tarek Ali should do? Drop dead?
Well, yeah,
well, that's great, isn't it? It's a good stand up turn, you know, but. You're really a serious party. You're saying,
he was chair of the Oxford Union.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Now he's gonna. He, you know, I'll tell you why I fucking hate Terry Harley. Isn't you? In 1968, there was a huge anti-Vietnam War demonstration, right? It was going to go to the American embassy in Grosvenor Square, and everyone was hyped up because there'd been an early one in March, and everyone was going. 3 days before the fucking event, Terry Arley decided we shouldn't go to the square, we should go to Hyde Park and have a picnic, and there's a load of hot air. He should never be fucking forgiven that. It wasn't for me, it was for those Vietnam peasants who were being burnt with napalm and Agent fucking Orange. So don't tell me Terry Arley's a good guy, he's a total fucking cunt.
It's okay, I'll know.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Right, Kieran,
would you like to come back on?
It's official.
He did, he took the wind out of that.
Yes,
in a way.
Yeah,
Sorry, can you...
I,
I think whenever you get left wingers, socialist, anarchists in a room together, I think after a while the discussion will tail off into a kind of pessimism and what can we do. Everyone's far too pessimistic, I think. I think that there are a large number in this country who could develop working class consciousness, radical working class consciousness, pretty quickly. Like, we've had the Vistian thing quite recently. Things are kicking off all over Europe. In Ireland, we're having sit-ins. Now, Lucy Parsons, who we were talking about, one of her suggestions in industrial strife, the sit-in strike, take over, kidnap bosses. Yeah. Don't just go off and starve, take over. Fuck that, that we're going to come crawling back with our tails between our legs and give what they offer us. You know, no, don't do that. There are lots of people who are very frustrated. You said there's a few working class people on the left who was, who were a bit frustrated. You must be kidding. We're all oppressed. We've got a mountain of debt pressing us into the ground. We've got middle, let's face it, middle class idiots running the country. Corruption. The corruption that we've witnessed now is comparable to the old corruption prior to the Great Reform Act in 1832. That led to open insurrection. Why are people not on the streets? I think a lot of people are thinking seriously about it. Why isn't there a movement now? Why are we out of practice at getting out on the streets, taking them on, an insurrection if necessary? People are thinking that, lots of people. So don't think that, well, we're isolated, marginal groups. We're keeping the socialist aspiration alive for people who've lost that culture because it's been destroyed and marginalised and smashed. And we need to shout it out loud and adopt militant positions, and others will follow, because there are so many disaffected people. Not just socialism is a middle class phenomenon. Where do you get that one from? If you look around the world, socialism is a strong living tradition involved in heavy day to day struggle, working people doing this. Now, if you're talking about the composition of left-wing groups at the moment in this country, it's a middle-class phenomenon. I think that is highly unlikely as well. I mean, I've not done research on this, and I suspect that you're assuming something there pretty big. And you're following conventional discourse when you say that. I mean, you're afraid you are. You are. Because socialism has been marginalised in these kinds of ways in the last 20 years. And we need to jump on that. Socialism belongs to us. It comes from us and it belongs to us. And we're the only people that can push it. And as far as Hazel Blears... Hazel Blears.
I love Hazel.
A good working class girl. An example of a careerist. An example of... I came across a classification of the working class when I was reading around some stuff to do this. And it was a sociological description from the 1960s. I think it was called Gordon Rose, the sociologist. It was basically a functionalist description. And it split up the working class into three. They always split things up into three. Some people don't know, but he did it. So his idea was you had the proletarian, who is your stereotypical working class man working in heavy industry, in unions, etc., etc. Then you've got the deferential worker, who agrees that the betters should be, you know, in control, they know better, and I'm not a very good person and I should improve myself, or I'm in the right place because I'm not very intelligent, and basically agrees with the class structure. And then you've got this, the people that Thatcher and subsequently Blair built their regimes upon, the privatised worker, aspirational worker, who accepts the system as it is, accepts the cash nexus, the wage system, the bosses. Hazel Blears is not alone, is she? I mean, many working class people have, and this is the correct term for it, sold out, adopted, sold out, defaulted. they're corrupt, they're traitors, they've betrayed us. Hazel Blears.
There's a lovely pub down the road, if anyone wants to continue this conversation, as I'm sure you will, or your it leads question. Really nicely into the next meeting, which is called Where Now for the Left. Thank you for coming, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.